I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You're listening to Text Message, the UK-focused technology podcast with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
Now, this week, Prime Minister Theresa May outlined a 12-step, quote-unquote, plan for pulling Britain out of the EU. Now, I've always been very open with you all here on my stance as a backer of the Remain camp, of course, but I won't deny I thought her speech contained at least a finite non-zero total of good ideas. That is to say, it wasn't all doom and gloom in my personal opinion, but it was predictably very light on references to technology. However, it was mentioned specifically in her, I think, 10th point, which included this promise, quote, "A global Britain must be a country that looks to the future. That means being one of the best places in the world for science and innovation. One of our great strengths as a nation is the breadth and depth of our academic and scientific communities, backed up by some of the world's best universities. And we have a proud history of leading and supporting cutting-edge research and innovation. So we will welcome agreements to continue to collaborate with our European partners on major science, research and technology initiatives," end quote. Now, she did go on to mention specifically space exploration, clean energy and medical technologies as those that Britain should triumph with. Or within. But that was kind of it. Though a little later in the week at the World Economic Forum in Davos in Switzerland, she did briefly refer to technology again in a speech, but just to say that, quote, "Britain is and always will be open for business, open to investment in our companies, infrastructure, universities and entrepreneurs, open to those who want to buy our goods and services, and open to talent and opportunities from the arts to technology, finance and manufacturing." So in short, kind of a reassuring nod, I suppose, that technology remains an important factor in negotiations during the Brexit talks. But precisely how those negotiations will manifest as changes, if you like, for us here in the UK is sometime, I think, away from being well known. That's what I call a things Theresa said this week about Brexit and tech segment, which we will return to over the coming months. But I thought it was worth not ignoring that, even though it did leave something to be desired. Ian, a nutshell of takeaway from you for that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you and me and our listeners all know that technology is, you know, really important. There's no denying that because obviously it's a huge industry. The problem is that without sort of investment and careful nurturing, there'll be no growth. And we've been very lucky with Europe, I think. And no matter what your stance on the EU, I would say that the funding bodies and the scientific community that exists within the European Union sits outside of the bureaucracy and has been extremely good for British science. And I think that we've contributed a lot. And I would hope it would continue. And she did make noises about that. You know, we will have funding, hopefully. It's absolutely critical, and it will be, if we do end up completely pulling out of Europe, it will be one of those things to really fight for, and I will continue to, obviously.
Yeah, and in terms of investment, that was obviously referenced massively there. You know, there are some key things that I think will be really important to see the development of, you know, one of which being the European Investment Fund, which, for anyone familiar with it, they will know that it underpins a lot of investments that benefit the UK. And that's definitely going to be something that we'll want to keep our eye on.
And we could keep paying into that, I assume. I mean, like if we wanted to continue, there wouldn't be anything stopping us doing that. It would be, I don't imagine the Europeans would have a problem with that particularly.
I think that's part of the negotiation, to be honest. That's one of the things that we've got to address is how that money is collected and how it's distributed back. But I think the bottom line is that as long as it benefits Britain, then it's likely that it will continue. And I would certainly argue that the European Investment Fund does indeed benefit British startups, certainly in terms of raising initial capital for stuff. But that's going a little bit too far down the business route for today's show until we have more concrete stuff to discuss. But obviously, if you do have any thoughts on these things, you can let us know at any time, podcast@natelangson.com. Or at Text Message Pod on Twitter, which is definitely becoming a more followed source of midweek news, measured in the hundreds though at the moment, and I know there's several thousand of you who listen, so some of you aren't following that account, at Text Message Pod. That's where you want to follow for midweek UK tech news, and where you can send opinions to Ian and I. We both monitor and tweet from that account. Now, let's talk about something that's not unrelated, I suppose, to Brexit, but certainly is relevant immediately to a lot more people. The App Store, Apple's App Store specifically, is going to raise prices by around 25% as a result of the pound having plummeted in value over the last few months. Specifically, they're going to rise, for example, a 79 pence app is now going to cost 79 pence. Sorry, it's not. That's what it costs now. 79 will cost 99 pence. That's 20p more. Or if you want to measure that in Freddo bars, it's what a Freddo bar cost around 2005, I believe. Do you remember when Freddo's cost 10p?
What is it about this bar that everyone seems to use as an international currency?
Freddo?
I don't understand. Yeah. I've seen it loads post-Brexit, and I don't understand.
Well, I don't know. I've actually never read it. I just pulled that out of my head.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the only time. Like, the Economist has something called the Big Mac Index, which sort of...
Ah, yes. Well, that's a well-known financial thing, right? That it makes sense. But, yeah, I'm sure I've seen lots about the Freddo bar. Who knows? I don't think I've ever even eaten a Freddo bar.
Well, you're missing out. It's a beautifully curvaceous piece of dairy milk in the shape of a very happy frog. I always start by eating the face first, so he doesn't... I don't have to stare into his eyes as I eat the rest of him.
Oh, is it like Colin the Caterpillar? Because, you know, Colin the Caterpillar, that face is prime real estate, isn't it, really?
Yeah, hopefully Colin prices will not be too negatively affected by the pound.
Colin is a British product, I believe, made in Britain, so I think we'll be okay.
We'll come back to discussion of British commodity pricing at such point the Newsweek is even slower than it was this week, which is why I've let that brief transgression into Freddo bar pricing continue unimpeded. But let's get back to the topic at hand. 7.99 apps will cost 9.99 and so forth right the way up the chain. So this is unsurprising. You know, we've seen a drop in the pound. We've seen price rises elsewhere. We're now seeing this being affected in app stores. A couple of things that I did notice. There was an email that went out to developers. I got hold of a copy of it, and they did say that subscriptions were not going to be immediately affected. So if you have an ongoing subscription, it's still at the moment in the hands of the developer or the publisher to rejig those prices relative to the pound. So they're not going to be affected. But in-app payments will be affected. Upfront payments will be affected. This is across iOS app stores and the Mac app store. Things like iBooks and Apple Music and things like that have not been targeted. But it's not unreasonable to think that the price of a single song download might go from 99 pence to higher.
Presumably, developers are able to compensate for this by reducing their prices, I guess.
Effectively, they can, but only if they're operating with a threshold above, you know, below which there's some movement. So if they were priced on the very lowest App Store tier, then the only way to go down is to go free or freemium in some form. There's no way for them to reduce it any further. No, they're going to, at the very lowest end, they're going to have to take the hit. But otherwise, yes, they could drop the price.
I mean, I don't think that 79 to 99 is going to cause anyone any concern. And I don't think 7.99 to 9.99 is going to cause much problem either, to be honest.
Well, I don't know, because I was thinking about this. I mean, the Super Mario Run game, the in-app purchase for that was 7.99. That's now going to be 9.99. And it's already struggling to some degree to gain traction, according to some figures. And increasing it by a further £2, that might be enough to throw people off, thinking, well, it's 10 quid as opposed to, you know, 7, which is how the brain probably works that out.
There was already a 9.99 pricing tier, right?
So yeah, there's loads. They go up to like nearly £1,000, but no one ever actually pays that.
You would have to be a very specialised app for £1,000, wouldn't it? But I mean, 9.99, over that, I think people will mentally struggle, I would say. You've got to be pretty sure, haven't you, you want an app for $9.99. Although I sort of support developers, you know, pushing the prices up a little bit, because I feel like if an app is really good and really useful, then I don't mind paying for it. Like, I bought Tweetbot, which is really quite an expensive app, actually, given that it's just a Twitter client. But, you know, it's two guys. They do it on their own. Twitter is absolutely no help. So, you know, I kind of feel like they should get support.
Well, these changes are going to be made over the next 7 days, according to an email sent to developers on the 17th of January. So that would stand to reason, I think, that you can expect the change maybe as soon as Monday. So if you are listening to this podcast on Sunday or possibly Monday, if the changes haven't gone into effect and you're thinking about buying an app, my advice is, as you're listening to the show, get it now before the price goes up if it's a pricey app. Otherwise, you might be paying a little bit more. We haven't heard anything from other app stores, Google, for example. At least if it is planning to make a change like this, it hasn't communicated it widely enough to be reported. So we'll still check back. But it's not unreasonable to expect that's too far down the line. I mean, developer pressure may possibly get to them, but we'll see. But let us know if you have any thoughts, podcast@natelangson.com or @textmessagepod on Twitter. Now, Ian, can I just check, are you a customer of the tax credits and self-assessment helpline provided by Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs?
I have outsourced all dealings with the HMRC to a rather expensive accountant because I just cannot face it. But I certainly am, because I'm a self-employed businessman, as it were, I am certainly subject to the whims of the HMRC, yes.
Well, you're not going to be subject, by the sounds of it, to the whims of the technology department behind the HMRC, who have decided to roll out a new system of voice identification for people sort of saying, I don't want to use an app to do this. I want to call a human. Well, now you can call a human and have some tech verify whether you are indeed a legitimate caller. It's announced this system where if you call up to discuss tax, for example, or payments, you'll go through a series of requests to speak some words, some phrases, up to maybe 5 times. After that, you'll be passed back to an advisor and you'll complete the call as normal. But the passphrases and the sentences that you were using initially are going to be stored. About 100 different characteristics about how you said those words are going to be stored. And the next time you call up, you'll be able to more speedily move through this authentication process because the system can detect from your voice alone whether you are you. And it says that it is extremely confident that this will prevent false positives and it will be extremely secure, nothing to worry about. And it's interesting because there are major banks that have been rolling out voice-activated tech for a while. HSBC, First Direct, Barclays, they've all had voice ID type systems in place for around about a year, maybe just under. But, you know, for all their customers, if they want them. Then there's things like Atom Bank, which is a challenger bank in the UK that lets you unlock your banking app using a selfie or effectively facial recognition as well. So a lot of people are trying this and it seems reasonable that HMRC would want to get in on this. The question is, how good is it going to be? And is it going to confuse the technophobes that it's allegedly there to help?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a bad idea, is it? I have grave concerns with ongoing use of passwords. They tend to be relatively easy to break.
Well, that's because most people have 123456 as a password.
Yes and no. I mean,
mostly yes.
On the one hand, On the one hand, I want to be the kind of tech journalist that sort of, you know, is perfect and never makes a mistake with passwords. But the reality of it is that some of my passwords are the same as some of my other passwords. And my accounts turn up in those have you been hacked databases. And I think, oh, here we go. Because obviously I do reuse passwords because I am fundamentally a human being. And I do not have time to mess around remembering different passwords. Now, of course, things that matter, I tend to put on a completely different set of passwords that are generated by a password manager. But I think that for most people, the real problem with passwords is that they're just impossible. It's not a natural thing for a human to do to remember a secure password. Now, often you could use a sentence instead of a word, but it would probably be better if we could do things where, you know, the security is seamless. And this is one of those examples. If it's reliable, then it gives you access to your account. They can be sure it's you. You know that no one can imitate you. I believe that voice print identification is actually extremely reliable, isn't it? And it says quite a lot that they're able to do it over a phone line. Phone line quality is not very good and the frequency response is fairly narrow. So if they're confident that they can distinguish two twins from each other, say, then there must logically be some pretty good science behind it. So I think it's great. Also, arguably, you know, the tax office isn't one of those things that's going to be a massive target for hackers anyway, I would assume. Because, you know, who wants to go through someone else's tax unless you're trying to find information about someone? But, you know, I like the idea of it. Anything that can make that process of dealing with HMRC easier, I think, would be welcome. And also, it could lift a burden from HMRC in terms of how much time they're wasting verifying people, because they're busy and they don't have enough staff. And this means that they don't have to say, right, you've forgotten your password, now we're going to go through this resetting process, so you're going to have to wait for a letter. It's just, it should help, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to go back to your point about it being clever that it can be done over the phone, it's interesting to look at just how much stuff can still be detected over the phone. There have been initiatives and researchers that can detect the early signs of Parkinson's.
Interesting.
Using a phone line, just because of the very small fluctuations in speech over, you know, just even a few seconds or a minute or so is enough to be able to detect certain things like that. And there have been a number of research papers and I think even usable practical experiments and phone lines or apps that can begin to detect this. It's a fascinating field. It's not one we have time to go into today, but, you know, just safe to say that there's a huge amount of data and vocal characteristic that can still come through something as old-fashioned as a copper-based phone line. So let's not completely rule it out, but the trial will involve a select number of people being asked to participate in this. They don't have to. It'll always be opt-out, and that's fine, or rather it'll be opt-in, so you don't have to take part in it, and that those who do opt-in will be able to take advantage of it over the coming weeks, and the trial is going to start this month, if not already as we speak. So I think it's very interesting, and if anyone does use this or has experience with it, we'd love to hear how it works, whether it's accurate, does it verify you the first time. podcast@natelangston.com if you are one of those people, or if you're willing to try it and just let us know how it goes. Well, continuing what I think is a very slow news week in British tech, Ian, let's talk about Instagram live video.
Oh, do we have to? No, I jest.
We do have to. We're about 20 minutes into the show and running out of steam a little bit. But Instagram launched this live feature called Instagram Stories, or Live Stories, I think, in December, just for the US. A month later now, that is, it's being rolled out to us in the UK, alongside our friends in Germany, France, Brazil, Canada, and Japan. Now, I've never made one of these Instagram Stories, but I have seen them. They're kind of like short slideshows that appear at the top of the bar. And I did notice this morning when I checked for this feature that it was live, and it is. You sort of swipe to the left, and you've got a option to just broadcast something live on Instagram. It disappears as soon as you're done, but a notification goes out to all your followers that someone they follow is going live. So it's very similar, I think, to Facebook's live platform, and it's out now, and that's kind of it. I have nothing else to say about this other than neat.
But it goes away, so it doesn't stay archived on your Instagram feed after you've used it.
Yeah.
Well, what's the point of that?
Well, it's meant to be. It's ephemeral.
Spare me. But you don't use Instagram to look at a photo just immediately after someone's taken it or while they're taking it. Like,
well, two things. Firstly, this isn't photos. This is video. This is live video.
I understand the premise, Nate. What I'm just saying is that why wouldn't they store that video and allow you to then, you know, for it to sit in your timeline or allow you to integrate it into stories in your own way? I mean, that just seems stupid.
I can think of several reasons, actually.
Well, I can think of one. They don't want to compete with Facebook live video.
There's an element of that, although, I mean, Facebook owns Instagram anyway.
That's why they don't want to compete with it, right? Because they don't want two products that do basically the same thing, although they are basically going to do that.
Possibly. I mean, there's been a whole other thread of stories this week outside of the context of the UK with Facebook live video basically having problems monetizing it. You know, there's engagement's very low, the publisher contracts aren't being renewed. It looks like Facebook live video is, you know, not in a healthy state. And maybe having something simpler like like Instagram, you know, as was the case with Periscope on the Twitter side of things.
Ah, well, it won't. That's why it won't work, because, and you know, because those video services offered by Twitter were exactly the same. Oh, I'm live on Periscope. You see the tweet as you're going through your timeline. By the time you press the button, they're off. It's stupid. It is absolutely stupid. And it would be easier to monetize a video if it stays online than it is to monetize it in the 3 minutes it's being posted live for. I wouldn't use it. If I was going to do live video, I'd do it on Facebook or YouTube, because both of those platforms have sensibly agreed that it would be better to have video that sticks around. I mean, you don't have to leave it up if you don't want to. If it is literally something that has, you know, only has any value in that 1 minute it's happening, then you can delete it again or hide it. But no one is going to watch it, because unless you're a multi-million subscriber Instagrammer, who's going to be online?
I think a lot of people will use this. I think that's why they're rolling it out, because people have been using this in the US. I think maybe it's because you have nothing that interesting to point a live camera at, perhaps.
No, that's absolutely true. And I would never claim to be an interesting person or a worthy of having a live stream about me at any given moment. And I also don't have very many Instagram followers, because I don't use it, because I find it actually quite an annoying platform. I'd rather put my photos on Twitter.
Well, this is good for debate then, because I would like to open this up to the floor. Maybe if this was live on Instagram, perhaps we could get some more real-time feedback. There's a suggestion.
This is a question that we've asked, right? People don't like live things, right?
I think it depends on the nature of the live thing. I could think that, you know, let's come up with a hypothetical here. Let's say there's some big event kicking off somewhere in the world, and there's a number of people at that event. That is actually a very good use of having live video, because you can search for those people, or you can see where those hotspots are and choose to watch something from a variety of angles, perhaps from a variety of levels of professionalism with a camera, let's say, and be a part of something there and feel like you're able to take in that event that you're not at by jumping between multiple different perspectives from various different live streams. Now, those are the sorts of videos that perhaps you don't want to stick around necessarily. You're not going to want to rewatch those. It's incredibly expensive to store tons and tons and tons of video of, you know, boring stuff that no one cares about watching. This allows people to, you know, to broadcast this stuff, and it allows the company to not have to worry too, you know, strenuously about how to keep it around.
So it's, no, I mean, I yeah, that's fine. I mean, if it's really a matter of them not being able to store that much data, I mean, you know, it's not going to be, is it?
No, I mean, it's strange, because Facebook has plenty of money. They have plenty of servers. They operate their own back end in terms of, you know, data storage and what have you. So they're certainly in the category of people that could store it, but they're also then in the category of people that have hundreds of millions of users. So even though they have the capacity to store this stuff, they do it on such massive scale that even having the ability could cost a huge amount, and then they have to, you know, make sure that's not negatively affecting their bottom line, like maybe Vine did with for Twitter. So
yeah, but I mean, like, Twitter's very different. Twitter isn't a massively profitable company, is it? And there's a lot of reasons for that. Whereas, you know, a company like Snapchat has worked out how to do monetization on all these things really well, and, you know, again, video sticks around, doesn't it? And like, you may only be able to watch it once, say, on Snapchat, but at least you can always have the opportunity to go back to it. And then, you know, if you've missed it the first time, or, you know, when it went out originally.
Let's see what the listeners, you beautiful ladies and gentlemen out there in the audience, what you think, and whether you do you listen, or rather, do you watch live videos on Instagram? Have you been watching live videos? Have you made live videos of Instagram? Have you got a really good example of what you watched live or produced live that made you think, yes, this is exactly the platform I wanted. This is better than YouTube Live. This is better than Facebook Live. This is better than Periscope. It's better than Vine or Meerkat or any of the other recent examples of live streaming that we've had. Why? What is that? And why have you felt it to be so compelling? Love to know this, because apparently Ian and I need a little bit of educating. It could just be because we're old, although Ian's older than me. But,
all right.
But
not steady by on, mate.
Not by a huge amount. But we're not. What we're saying is we're not 18. So maybe this. Maybe there's some younger listeners that can explain this to us a little clearly. Podcast at natelangson.com or at text message pod on Twitter. I have an Instagram account. I don't know what it is. I think it might be at Langson101. You're welcome to follow me on there. I posted a picture of a newsagent yesterday on the train station of Black Horse Road near Walthamstow.
Oh, sounds captivating.
It was, mate. I'll be honest, it was. It was a delightful picture. I was waiting for Kate to park the car before coming to meet you at the Wetland Centre in Hammersmith. Anyway, podcast.
Where we saw a gigantic Lego kingfisher.
We did, and several other large Lego animals. It was a delightful day. Delightful
it
day.
Was.
You know what? Maybe I'll post something on Instagram from yesterday. And we'll...
What a good idea. Maybe I'll do the same.
If only we'd have done it live. This week, a few... I hesitate to use the word interesting things happened with BT. Let's just say several things happened that collectively made me think they should be included on the podcast to do with BT. The first was that BT has announced a price hike for broadband and landlines and sport. This, according to the BBC reports I read, announced that about 5 to 6% increases are expected for customers of BT broadband and television and stuff. Broadband specifically is going to go up by about £2 a month. The Infinity broadband, that's the cable, the fibre optic stuff, is going to go up about £2.50, as we actually say here. BT television customers will have to start paying £3.50 a month for BT Sport, at least from the next sports season, whenever that is, because I only discovered this week that apparently that was a bundled thing that was just rolled into the broadband package, but that's been split out and going to come at an extra cost now. And then calls are going to go up per month. Anytime calls are going to go up to $8.99 for that unlimited call package. So overall, some increases. I saw a lot of people headlining and calling this out as, irresponsible price hikes. I looked into the details. I thought, well, actually, recently we've talked about price hikes from Virgin. We've talked about them from Sky. It seems in line. And then I looked at the bottom line and saw they're not increasing the price of line rental or dramatically hitting people on the lower end tariffs. So I sort of actually decided for once, to sort of accept that a price hike here was probably not that terrible in line with the rest of the market. Are you a BT customer, Ian? I can never remember.
No, I'm not. What I would say about this is that Sky and Virgin, to some extent, because obviously Virgin sort of follows Sky because it's a big customer, Sky at least has the fact that it does a lot of business with the US as a sort of an excuse for putting prices up, like especially when the pound falls, because obviously it has to buy most of its programming in from the States. So the exchange rate must have some bearing on that, presumably. BT's services are almost entirely in the UK. Like there isn't really, I mean, aside from... I don't know, having to pay staff more or something. I don't disagree with you. It isn't an unreasonable price hike. I think also BT Sport, they probably needed to get that out from being free because it probably will cause them legislative problems in the future if they don't, because it's essentially a slightly anti-competitive bribe, because they're spending so much money on it that... And it's not making any money for them, obviously, because it was just bundled for customers. So I feel like Sky will start complaining to Ofcom about that fairly soon if they don't get on with removing it as a freebie. So I sort of understand that one.
I think that the BT Sport versus Sky Sport bidding war is probably a big driver behind this as well, if not more than that regulatory issue.
Yeah.
Because they are spending... Multiple billions of pounds each to secure rights for these various games. I think the BT secured the Ashes, I think, for cricket next year or this year. They're spending just in huge amounts of money on this, and it's not core to their business from the perspective of being a broadband provider. So it makes sense to split it out. But how much of that was driven by regulatory concerns or anti-competitive concerns, I don't know. But it does seem to make a lot of sense. And maybe this would allow people who don't care about sport, for example, me, would I be a BT customer, to not feel indignant that I'm paying £4 a month for things I don't use. So I think
I would say that's the understandable. Yes, no, and actually that's a good point, because basically at the moment they're subsidising it based on their general customer base, many of whom don't take that as a bonus. excuse me, sorry. I think it's less fair that they're putting up the prices of broadband and phone calls particularly, because it costs them literally nothing. And that's what that irks me, because it isn't like there isn't a cost behind making phone calls, really.
Per call, I agree, but there is a huge legacy backbone that needs to be supported and upgraded.
Sure, but at the same time, people are making fewer and fewer phone calls, I would imagine.
Now, this is interesting, because I actually thought about this just yesterday. I was sitting on a bus, again, on my way to meet you at the Wetland Centre. and I was on this bus for about 2 hours, because I stupidly thought that it would take less time and I'd be able to hatch some Pokemon as the bus trundled its way down Oxford Street. But it turns out there was a giant anti-Trump protest going on, and so it took me forever. And Kate, my fiance, who was actually at this rally, was trying to send me pictures, and WhatsApp and everything was crashing. But SMS worked absolutely fine, no problem, which went through. Whereas historically, it's SMS that was always crashing. And, you know, you remember New Year's Eve around sort of 2000, 2001, you know, a lot of people had mobile phones, network would crumble. You could never call family to wish them Happy New Year. But now it seems that those legacy fallback systems are very, very capable, because they're not being overloaded.
No one using them. Right, yeah. Because obviously they're rubbish and you can't send photos, and people just hate them, despite the fact they're point to point and the most secure kind of messaging. You know, if you don't want people looking at them, I mean, obviously the network can look at them, but
yes, indeed. But that's a tangent. Let's move on to another thing that I noticed BT doing, and we'll end on this. I think this week we were gonna talk a little bit about them blocking nuisance calls automatically now, but I basically summarized that news in a sentence.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, the call blocking thing has some value, I would say.
Go on then. Give me an explanation what this is.
People are generally very annoyed by nuisance calls. It is one of the most annoying things that can happen to you, because this is someone coming into your home to sell you something, essentially. And BT's got this system now where they will divert them to voicemail or something like that. Or not even voicemail. They'll just divert them away from your landline and get rid of them, which I think is good, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I've had a couple of these automated ones where you wait about a second for the voice to start and then it's clearly a robot, so you hang up. And they do come in from strange numbers and number ranges, and I think that's apparently one of the things that the team based in Shropshire, apparently, for BT, is going to be focusing on, is identifying these call ranges and blocking them automatically, as you described.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, they should have done this years ago. There are plenty of sites on the internet that catalogue nuisance phone calls and explain what they are. So when I get a phone call, I don't know the number. I type in the number into Google, look at the page, and it will say, oh, this is Sky trying to sell you Sky, or it's Barclays customer service trying to get in touch with you for some reason. So, you know, so if they can do it, then surely BT must be able to, you know, get a handle on it. And also, it'll mean that people will be much more confident about picking up the phone. They'll know that it's much less likely to get a junk call.
Well, I think Vodafone introduced something similar to this last year in the autumn.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, you're right. They did. Yeah, and again, I'm amazed that BT is so far behind. Really. Get a VoIP line. I don't use a BT line or a Virgin line. I just have all my calls. Well, I say all my calls. Who are the people that call you on your landline, Nate?
I don't have a landline.
Ah, right. Well, if you did have one, I'd tell you who it would be. It would be
my mum.
Your mum and Kate's mum.
Yes.
And, you know, because that's just those are the people that use landlines. I have a VoIP line. I have it exclusively for parents to call on. And that's it.
It's interesting to learn the scale of this problem, then, that something like this needs to be in place. BT said that about 30 million nuisance calls a week take place across its network. So it's clearly a problem, and 30 million nuisance calls is certainly no small number of nuisance calls that you know, might encourage people to want to switch their numbers or switch providers, just get away from it. So
yeah,
it makes sense for something like this to exist, and apparently that's live now. But the other thing, final thing that I did want to talk about that BT talked about this week was the launch of something called Whole Home Wi-Fi, which is essentially £300 for three Wi-Fi repeaters that increase the range and speed of your Wi-Fi throughout your home, most notably, I think, large homes or old homes, houses that have maybe lots of interference or very thick walls or multiple floors. It's something that addresses those sorts of properties. And it's interesting timing because we've seen a few of these sorts of things roll out recently, or at least be announced. There's one from, it's called Orbi. Is it Logitech? No, not Logitech. Who makes Orbi?
I
forget the name. There's one called Orbi. There's another one that, from Google, called Google Wi-Fi, which was announced in the US. It's not out here yet. They're all quite expensive. The BT one is going to cost £300, as I just say, and you get three of these repeaters. One plugs into your router, and then you put another one maybe on the second floor or on the third floor of your mansion, and they all sort of intelligently work together to give you the best signal based on where you are. And then there's, Google's works the same. That's priced at $300 for three of these similar things, which is currently about £242, so a little cheaper. The Orbi one that I saw is £400 RRP on Amazon, at least right now. So these are not cheap devices, but since Apple killed its range of routers, its AirPort Express and AirPort Extreme, which I have a couple of that I bought because they're very handy, I don't know. I sort of feel like I needed to replace those and buy a couple of extra ones, but they were too pricey. So I'm now in the market for these things. And the price of them is putting me off because I don't really want to pay £300 to just get better Wi-Fi.
So, I'll tell you something as well. They probably won't work because I've done a lot of this over the years. I've had I've got a very, very good Linksys router and the package they sent me to test it included a repeater. Which I dutifully plugged in another bit of the house, which sort of sometimes has quite weak service, doesn't work. It does not work. And I think if you had a wired repeater, you'd have more luck. But
who wants Wi-Fi wires? Ones, this is 2017.
Well, that's the thing. I'm actually fine with wires. And in the past, what I've done is I have a wire that goes outside my house and round and provides stuff, you know, internet for the on-demand TV and all that kind of stuff. So I've just wired in an extra router around there usually. But I thought, well, it is less hassle to have a Wi-Fi thing that perhaps you can move. Say if you go out to the garden or something, you could move it a bit closer to the garden and get some signal out there in the summer. But my experience with them is absolutely dreadful. I'll put them in my phone. And I don't know if it's something to do with them using the same SSID or something like that, or you know, some tangential problem. But I find that they are not good at doing what they're supposed to do. And it's a very bad customer experience. And if you're spending £300, you want to be pretty sure it's going to work. Now, I suspect, because Sky does this with Sky Q, the extra pieces of, you know, the extra boxes you can get all do Wi-Fi repeating. So they must have worked it out and sorted the problem out. So,
I prefer to lean on the side of the positive here, because while repeaters and Wi-Fi repeaters and extenders have been around since, you know, basically as long as wireless routers have been around, these at least claim to be of a different category. They claim to be smarter. They claim to be a lot more intelligent. The BT one comes with an app that you can install on your phone to monitor things like who's connected to which device, how is performance.
Dee-woo.
All this thing. No, but I'm just saying that there's a more concerted effort to sort of improving this experience, possibly as an acknowledgement that the existing solutions have been crap.
Yeah.
So what I'm actually going to try and do is get hold of one or two of these types of devices, because I live in, I think, quite a good example house for using this. It's a bungalow that we bought, but it was built in the 1960s, so it has thick brick walls throughout. And because it's a bungalow, it's very, very long. And the Apple AirPort Extreme that I have sits on a bookcase at the very extreme end of one of our rooms, but our bedroom is on the very opposite end of the bungalow, and signal through there is poor. When I bought, if I didn't buy, it was a review model at the time that I had from Apple for a few weeks to test some network stuff. We set another one up in Kate's office, which is adjacent to the bedroom, and signal was great. So these things can work.
Yeah, I mean, if they've done what Apple did, then yeah, it'll be fine. I think there's a lot about you know, how they do what they do. There's lots of different ways of doing it, I imagine. In fact, I sort of pretty much could tell you that there almost certainly are. That's a great sentence. What a wonderful positive way of putting a sentence is.
Indeed.
To just muddle around with no actual words at all. Just cut that out. I'm sure they will. I'm sure that, like Apple, these systems will work a lot better.
I hope so. Well, I'm going to try and get hold of some and do a little test maybe for the podcast. And if you've got any of these listeners, then feel free to let us know. podcast@natelangson.com. let's check in with Tom Merritt of Daily Tech News Show and hear about what's been happening in the wider world of technology this week.
Hey, thanks, you guys. This week on Daily Tech News Show, we discussed just how much Mark Zuckerberg's New Year's resolution to visit people in every state in the U.S. looks like a political campaign. We examined why Valve speaks to its fans with products, not blog posts, examined the decision not to recall Tesla Autopilot after the death of a man in a crash in Florida last year, and in light of the popular anime selfie app Meitu, discuss why apps collect so much personal data from you and what the risks are in letting them. All that and more at DailyTechNewsShow.com.
Well, Ian, I've got half a cup of tea left, but I've got a mouthful of happiness thanks to today's program.
We've done it. Worst case, we could talk absolute nonsense about anything, can't we, really?
History has suggested that consistently that is indeed the case.
I'm still more than capable of having a whinge, as perhaps today's show has indicated, but ultimately I'm also getting old and I can't be bothered with it. I do feel like we do a relatively good job on this show of trying to examine a topic in detail, but there is a difference between finding out the downsides to something and just endlessly whinging about absolutely everything.
More of this next week, ladies and gentlemen. See you then.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.